Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Man, let's just jump into it because I'm not one to, again, I looked at your quick background and bio and it blew me away. I mean, everything from, and correct me if I'm wrong on any of these things, but you were a fine dining chef, chemical engineer, transitioned to mushroom farming, and then got an ag science degree.
Correct.
All of it. That's absolutely insane for anyone at any level. So I have to know ultimately how you fell into food and what that journey was like.
Well, that's pretty crazy. Like back whenever I was young out in West Texas, you could either join a football team and do well there or pretty much just go out and get in trouble. there wasn't much else to do. And I just ended up hanging out with a bunch of people who it's kind of a rough crowd, I guess. And, fortunately, I got out of Midland and got into success. But back in those days, there wasn't much. And I decided I was going to kind of drop out of school and just go get a job. And that's what it was. It was about making money. And there was a Mexican restaurant not too far away from where I was doing some work at an old folks home. As like a 14-year-old. I was doing a work at an old folks home for a couple hours a day, kind of vacuuming and serving food. Because, you know, you can't get a full job whenever you're really young. But I wanted money and I wanted to support like my habits of wanting to go out and be emancipated as a minor. You know, I was 14 years old. I needed money. So living out in West Texas, if I could get like a couple of $100 a month, that would be enough for an apartment. And that's what I worked on. So I went and worked at this old folks home. And then right across the alley from that was a Mexican restaurant. And I had a couple of other friends who were like, hey, if we go work over there, I can get us in without having to be 16 years old. Like, I know somebody who will just hire us and be full time. So just so happens that guy went over to do it. And whenever they called him back for an interview, I was at the place because this was before cell phones, right? This was back in 1990 something, like right when cell phones were starting. 94, I guess. And I was at the place where they called the landline for him to be, and he just wasn't there. I picked up the phone and I'm like, hi, yeah, no, he's not here. They said, well, we need somebody to come work today. I'm like, I'm down. I want to come in. So I came in and they didn't check anything. You know, I was, 14 years old and started working in a Mexican kitchen. And I thrived. Like, it was great. Like, they gave me money for working hard. And I did that for 6 years and sort of went up through the ranks working batch cooking and working all the little sections in a restaurant and found out that if you just like go into the work and you're like good at stress, like using stress to make you work hard, that a kitchen is the right place for you. So, yeah, I got trained by people who were from all over the U.S., but also all over from Mexico. So it was a Mexican restaurant and we had people coming to Midland, Texas, which is not like a map destination, but the people who did live there, some of them liked fine dining and good food. And this just so happened to be like one of the upscale Mexican restaurants. And we had people coming in through who had been through the Culinary Institute of America. And, you know, we were that kind of attraction in a small town, nice food. So I got exposure to lots of different people and lots of different styles of cooking, even though it was all about Mexican food. And I just learned Mexican food in and out. Being from West Texas, I had always had the exposure to barbecue, always loved that style of cooking too. But then I took on the ability to know Mexican food, like in and out through and through. And whenever I met my wife, we met online. We met probably in 1995, 96 on a program called IRC, Internet Relay Chat.
Yes, and, I remember IRC.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just ended up that she had the ability to come to the US to finish her degree. So she was working on her postdoc and in cancer research. And it just so happened to put her about 6 hours from my front door in San Antonio, Texas. So I was out in Midland, grew up out there. And then by the time that she ended up coming over, I moved out to San Antonio to go meet up with her. And, you know, still married, I moved over to Australia to follow her. We've got a couple of kids, you know, long, happy story. But I moved out to San Antonio. And whenever I told my regional manager at the Mexican restaurant, I'm going to move out to San Antonio. Why don't, because we have a branch of this restaurant out there. I'll just go there. That'll make that easy. And he's like, no, man, you need to go excel. And San Antonio is like a good culinary capital. I've got some inns at some nice restaurants. Like I'll send you some recommendations. And I just ended up following through that recommendation. Went to work at Biga on the Banks. It's a James Beard nominated place, one of the top five in Texas. You know, it still exists to this day. It is like, it's a culinary destination. And that was under Chef Bruce Auden. So whenever I moved out there, I knew that like getting rid of all of the, you know, the youthful fun, dodging responsibility activities was kind of over, because I was meeting up with my soon to be wife and, you know, gonna make a run at being a good full grown, you know, tax paying individual, good citizen. Right. So went and got a job at that fine dining restaurant and decided I'm going to go back to school. I'm going to go get a degree in something. And, you know, let's just be real good at this. So I went back to school for chemical engineering at the University of Texas at San Antonio and San Antonio College. Got my associates in that. Over the next 6 years, we were there together in San Antonio. I worked my way through that kitchen, stayed at that kitchen the whole time, up to banquet chefing. Got so much culinary exposure to so many different ingredients that I'd never seen, you know, because this was called modern cuisine. So it wasn't like any one specific style. We had a rotating menu, so it was seasonal. We had chefs coming through who had backgrounds in Asian and all different styles of European cooking. And I just got to work hand in hand, you know, elbow to elbow with a bunch of different people, lots of different influences. And we would sit down after work and have like long chats about specific things. Like we even got into, just like people do book clubs, we did kind of ingredients clubs where we'd all sit down and talk about something that we had gone away and researched and then brought it back to the group. So it would be wine or cheese or mushrooms or, you know, some specific type of vegetable, and then what all uses and what all cuisines that would work into. So like we were in a bubble. And that just, you know, accelerates your culinary desires, really. And it was the right environment for that. And long before I ever knew I was going to get involved with mushrooms, I went away on that little mushroom investigation. And I kind of fell in love with them as an ingredient long before I ever knew that they were so functional and that there was so much more to their evolutionary history. I just loved them as an ingredient. And when I would cook them as a vegetarian meal or as a side dish, this place that I was at, Biga, they would spend so much on having really interesting stuff coming through. So we'd have morels and chanterelles and porcini and like all these fresh mushrooms. And out in Texas, you just don't have a lot of people with the long history of use of fresh mushrooms. So fortunately, the mushrooms themselves lend to amazing textures and flavors. But when you get involved with like working with them, you can work so many different textures and flavors out of individual mushrooms. So that's what I spent time sort of doing. And the fact that I was going to school for chemical engineering at that time, like I was really deep in sort of chemistry and the reactions that were going on in the functionality of the kitchen.
Yeah, and that's chef, I was gonna ask you real quick about that.
Yeah.
The chemical engineering piece, how that played into, you know, you're in culinary school. I don't know many culinary students or people that are in the in the industry that'll go, you know what, I'm gonna go do some chemical engineering. But was it like the peak in the interest? I've been doing a lot more R&D lately. I'm not an R&D chef, but I like today was a blast working with a ground chicken and figuring out why it's reacting in the cook times, and we figured out we need to put some dextrose in the product to get the sugar to create a mild reaction. Was it stuff like that that piqued your interest that you were like, that's why I went, or did you just pick chemical engineering to pick it and then it just kind of went hand in hand with food and how food science is?
Yeah, well, really good question. And it's the first time anyone's ever asked me the question. Normally, I do kind of lead anytime I do tours and talks with, I come from West Texas, lots of barbecue and lots of oil out there. And what I was aware of, just like I didn't go into football and you know, get into scholarships out of that, if I were going to stay in Midland, Texas, and stay in Texas, period, there's a lot of oil there. And a lot of people go out making tons of money, risking their lives, climbing up the oil rigs and, you know, busting their backs. But the guys who make more money are the chemical engineers who work out in the oil field and the landmen. You know, it's like I was thinking about chemical engineering from the perspective of I want to make more money than the people who work hard. I want to work hard here. And that's the way I want to walk out of university making 100K. But I moved out to San Antonio and fell in love with food. So it's like, you know, there's a whole bunch of chemical nature to food, but I didn't ever see myself going back to West Texas or getting back into the oil field. So that chemical engineering degree didn't seem too like it was going to serve me too well on the path that I was on. And the thing about it is my chef, Bruce Auden, noticed that I had a really different approach to the way that I would develop food recipes for his rotating menu. So he would always like ask the chefs to suggest a dish or suggest a compilation for the menu. And my R&D, because he gave everybody the opportunity to be R&D chefs as well as line cooks and as well as, you know, banquet chefs and as well as all the other stuff. It's like, yeah, put together stuff that tastes good. Go and find good combinations and pairings and put those together and let's put them on the menu. So he noticed that my approach was different and so did everybody else. So he actually recommended to me, I'm looking at behind me now because I've got the book here somewhere, On Food and Cooking by Harold McGee. Actually, I think it's out in my kitchen right now. But it's the science and lore of the kitchen. And it just, it he's, he didn't come from a culinary background either or a science background, I don't think, you know, but he ended up writing The Science and Lore of the Food. And it just had a different sort of view of the science of the kitchen. And so did I. It introduced people like Heston Blumenthal in the very introductory pieces of the book. And, you know, like Ilbeli. I got the reference point to very scientific sort of minded cooking. And that's pretty much where I got exposed to Heston. And later on in my career, you know, the script got flipped and I got to be his mushroom expert in Thailand. And we ended up meeting up and that's how he's attached to our brand. But yeah, I admired him. I took him as an inspiration from early days in my career over 20 years ago, because my chef recognized that I had that sort of chemical science approach to the whole cooking aspect of everything.
Very cool.
So that's pretty much how I got in. Yeah.
That's a very unique story. And I love hearing everyone's position and how they got into it, especially where they land. It's not always how you get into it. Cause like you had that kind of traditional, got in early, just doing whatever, right, at a restaurant to make money.
Yeah.
But then it really progressed into something bigger. But what's really cool about this industry is who you run into, right? I'm at NRA. It was the last day. I'd been working booths. And I'm walking down the plant section, just doing some filming. And you guys were all huddled at the Fable table in the plant better for you section. And you guys had an award. And I was like, oh, this looks fun. Let me record these guys. And I know some mushroom farmers here in Chicago. So like I've gotten more into the mushroom scene with everything from, you know, Lion's Mane, and they do oysters and they do tinctures and some really cool stuff. So I was like, man, I got to see them. And then that's when literally just popped and said, let's do a quick interview, and met you. Yeah. And I was like, man, I have to talk to this guy more in detail. So maybe give just a quick, what is Fable? Who is Fable? I hadn't heard you until I had shown up and then started to do some research and tried the product and was really blown away.
Yeah. Well, cool. Thanks for that. I was only there for a couple of days and ended up meeting so many cool people like in the space of just a few hours. And it was just one after the other. And they were all kind of lots of repeat people coming back in. just because like this is the last day I had to get this again, or, you know, come and share details or whatever. So there was so much excitement around those last couple of days. And normally I don't do any of those sort of expositions or anything like that. I'm the developer, you know. I'm not a sales guy. I don't know what customers we have and all that kind of stuff. So it's just like I was there to bring the vibe, and I'm pretty sure you came in and we were all vibing like crazy. So it was it was wonderful. Fable, we're out in Australia is where we got our start, but now we are over in the States. So we got a few salespeople over there. Our CEO moved over about a year ago to New York, and we're, you know, we have a presence with lots of different distributors over there now. And we're both in, we started out in New York and LA, and now we're sort of got whole country distribution, and we're up in Canada too. But we got our start way back in 2019 over here in Australia, when myself, another mushroom farmer, and a third co-founder, his name is Michael Fox, and the other mushroom farmer's name is Chris McLaughlin. We all set out on our own individual journeys to bring mushrooms to the center of plate as a traditional protein, like to mimic a traditional protein. It's really hard to speak about what it is because it's not your typical plant-based food, and plant-based has had its own sort of ups and downs. And mushrooms, like from the beginning, I was like, let's not call it plant-based. Let's not call it plant-based. Let's not do that. Let's be fungi. Let's be mushrooms. And it took us about 3 years to sort of get on the train with saying, okay, we're not plant-based. Some of our first packaging was all plant-based and yada, yada. But it never was. It was like I took this weird long journey of whenever I left food in San Antonio, I went out to California with my wife. She got a job offer out there working in cancer research, and I still hadn't got a visa to move to Australia. So we were out in California for a couple of years, and I decided no more chemical engineering out there. I had my degree, but I didn't want to put it to use. I didn't want to go into the restaurants anymore. What I wanted to do was utilize science adjacent. And I went onto Craigslist, and out there in California, in the North Bay area, they were looking for a spawn supervisor in Sebastopol on a mushroom farm. That's all it said. They didn't want to bring in a whole bunch of, I guess, you know, shroom people. So they're like looking for a spawn supervisor, and had some like scientific buzzwords. And I was like, hey, that sounds cool. And I like mushrooms as an ingredient. So I went there and I ended up getting a job on a mushroom farm, living and working on the mushroom farm. And that's where it all sort of happened for me. I saw the functional nature, the chemical aspect. I was living in the North Bay area of San Francisco, where it rains 9 months out of the year. So there's always mushrooms in nature. So not only did I live and work on a mushroom farm, I started like taking on the hobby of going mushroom hunting. There's lots of expertise in the community. So it's easy to become an expert of certain areas, and then starting looking at reference material and just learning evolutionary history, taxonomy. Like, this was my jam. Everything about them was new, interesting, and not many people outside of being a mushroom person knew anything about it. So it's like, you could be the most interesting person at the party by knowing like about Lentinula edodes, or, you know, it's like you bring in your, a lot of people can do a lot of things. You know, some people can play guitars and that makes them interesting. Some people can talk to you about porcini till no end, and that's interesting too. So like, it's like just another way to be interesting to yourself, and that makes you interesting to other people. I was like, this is totally, I love this. If nothing else, I wanted to get the name, the spawn supervisor, like while I was living in California. I wanted to be a spawn supervisor until we moved to Australia. Anyway, fell in love with it, every aspect of it. Mushrooms became hobby, life, everything. Like when I wasn't working on the farm, I was working in the field and I was doing all kinds of experiments. I loved it, loved it, loved it. So when we moved to Australia, I did that. I built mushroom farms. I went and got a degree in agricultural science, because now it's like chemical engineering isn't the thing. Agricultural science is as close as I could get to a mycology degree, because they didn't have mycology degrees here. But I focused on everything that I could, focusing on mycology, water, compost, plant disease, everything fungi that I could put into an agricultural science degree. And yeah, because I could transfer in a whole bunch of credits, I ended up graduating with agricultural science just a couple of years after coming here, focused on mycology, and I was growing mushrooms that whole time in a farm in the backyard, to the fruit and veg wholesale market here. That's where I sort of got into the industry over here, started as a mushroom farmer. And then once I graduated, I was like, I'm going to go either deep research, cure cancers, cure diabetes, or go into mushroom farming and grow lots of mushrooms and make lots of money. And of course, whenever you just finish university, it's like, I see dollar signs, I'm going that way. And I ended up having massive business failures because I didn't know the market in Australia. So, grew lots of mushrooms. They were beautiful, wonderful. But I couldn't sustain what I was doing before, where I was selling 30 to 40 kilos of mushrooms a week. Mm. And my business plan walking out of university was going to be, increasing that to 300 or 400 kilos a week. But whenever I graduated, I ended up getting a call from a guy up in Shepparton. It's a big fruit growing area up here, who had all these rooms and all this space to convert to mushroom growing. And I was like, I could come up there and see what's up. And he had the space to grow 10 tons a week. I was like, let's do that. And we started out growing like a ton a week, 2 tons a week. And I could only sell like 300 kilos a week. So I ended up failing in business really fast. Ended up needing to go work on a mushroom farm to sort of get out of trouble. Turns out they needed a spawn supervisor 20 minutes up the road from my brand new remortgaged home after going into this failed business venture. And when I say that spawn supervisor is a shallow talent pool, that's shallow in America where there's 300 million people. Here, there's 20 million people back in those days. There's 25 now. It's 20 million people here. Spawn supervisor is a big ass. There's no one in spawn. So whenever I went with my resume of having spawn supervisor experience for a couple of years, the largest mushroom farm in the Southern Hemisphere called me back within a few minutes. They're like, are you joking? Like, you're lying, right? You've just copied this. No, I've got it. And within a day or two, I was down there with the interview. They offered me this huge cash to come and do it. I was like, I need this. Thank you very much. Anyway, I ended up getting out of the debt cycle and paid off everybody. Then that's whenever we went out realizing that I want to do something with all this waste that was on this mushroom farm. So this large mushroom farm in the Southern Hemisphere grows 350 tons of agaricus. That's the white button mushrooms a week. And that business, conglomerate of businesses grew something like 600 tons of mushrooms a week. And just on that one farm alone, they had 75 tons a week of offcuts, stems that had some soil attached to the bottom of them. But all the rest of that stem was like beautiful fibrous food. And along the path, I ended up going vegan for a year. I'm not a vegan now, but for a year, I was staunch, hardcore. And this was during that year that I was working there. I realized that there was all of this fibrous mushroom material that when you cook it, you get really meaty tastes as well as meaty textures. So when you think about what a meat is, like a muscle,
yeah.
And that muscle is made up of protein fibers. Fiber is one of those weird words that gets thrown around for everything. Like whenever you think of the macronutrient fiber, it is a carbohydrate. It is not a protein. It is, it's not cotton, but even though cotton is cellulose, which is a carbohydrate. So it is, but you wouldn't expect to eat cotton and call that food. It is what that is. It's a polysaccharide. So anyway, fiber gets thrown around in a lot of ways. And that's something that you learn whenever you're an R&D chef and you're like, well, I know there's fiber in here and the fiber is doing something. In this case where I started falling into it, I realized there's all this fibrous structured stem that's wasted. If I just cut off the base of it, I can cook it to develop the meaty taste and I can work to get rid of the excess water to make it have more of a meaty texture. So a lot of people over here, like it was even a marketing campaign for a while, they called mushrooms meat for vegetarians. And throughout my entire career, people would always say, well, mushrooms are the most meaty things that you can cook that's not meat. So it's always mushrooms have been meaty. The couple of different qualifiers there are that mushrooms do have a high amount of glutamic acid, glutamates. So they have that meaty umami. And then mushrooms do have that meaty chewiness where they have a bit more of a resilient bite so that they are more sort of rubbery instead of what a vegetable might be when you cook it, that, you know, gets a bit mushy or snappy or whatever. So they do have these couple of elements of meatiness. And along the journey of being a 1 year vegan, eight months in, I went back to Texas, and, you know, it's a promise to myself to do it for a year. But while I was in Texas, I was exposed to my cultural heritage food, that barbecue. And I was like, look, I can't torture myself. And my family didn't go on this journey with me, you know? So it's like, I was excluding myself from my tribe by being a vegan in Texas. So while I was there, I decided I'm going to eat it. But when I came back, I realized I had this fibrous stuff and the ability, like within me, knowing the chemistry of cooking, knowing how you can manipulate things so that you can develop not only taste, but texture. And I had those early versions of sort of barbecue, slow cook style meat in my mind when I'm using these fibers of mushrooms. And I also like wanted to really work to fool myself that I'm eating something meaty. And my bigger thought there is that if I could make something that I could take back to my family as a vegan and cook it in similar ways and apply the same techniques and just sort of be around in the tribe and eat the same preparations, but just with a different ingredient, then that would be the acceptable outcome of this. And that could not only help me, that could help a lot of people. So it ended up being, well, okay, now I've got this ability to turn these mushrooms into something quite meaty with a burger patty and like really individual fibers that felt like slow cooked meat. That was, let's do this in a way that helps more people. And as a vegan, you know, my coming to veganism was about sustainability. Everybody comes to it from a different standpoint. And there are kind of three major ones. There's like animal ethics, where you've got the people who will go out and protest, you know, because they don't want to hurt animals. And then you've got the people who do it for health reasons. You know, it's like, you know, I don't want to eat the cholesterol and the fat and the carcinogens or whatever. And then there's the people who do it, like me, for sustainability, knowing that traditional proteins are heavy resource requirement. You know, you would have heard some of the stats that, you know, 1 kilo of beef requires 10 kilos of grain, and that 10 kilos of grain, every kilo of grain requires 10,000 liters of water. And then, of course, you need to water the animal. So it's like 15,000 liters of water for 1 kilo of beef, where you could have all that other grain to feed people or animals or whatever, right? So my whole thing was around sustainability, because I love the taste of meat, and I never really had the problem with animal ethics. Like, I grew up in a place that was about animal husbandry, and I do understand that as long as it's not industrial animal agriculture, that agriculture is quite useful, you know, not only for people, but for the environment. And so Fable starts with a mission to help and industrial animal agriculture. That's our mission. And that's where, you know, I developed those early stages of it there out of being vegan. That's my come to, why I got into it. And then along the journey, I ended up meeting other people in the industry. That's where Chris McLaughlin, the other mushroom farmer, came in. Because when I stopped working at the mushroom farm and went to sell mushrooms in a market, like, selling them wasn't a thing for me, but I could do it because I love mushrooms, and I couldn't sell you beans or potatoes, but I could sell mushrooms. Anyway, I ended up meeting Chris, another mushroom farmer, who wanted to bring me in to do ferments and nutraceutical stuff, lots of functional food out of fungi, and potentially do a development of making mushrooms into a food. So along the way, we realized that's a really interesting aspect of doing business. We can take the waste from a mushroom farm, turn it into a product. Let's do it. Let's go get some funding. On the journey to find funding back in 2019, I think this was basically June 2019, we ended up coming across Michael Fox, our third co-founder, who had just closed up a business of his own the year before. In women's shoes, he had a long journey through finance and building a brand and the whole marketing and finance and working with investors side of thing. So he had his own vegetarian journey around ethics and health to get into veganism and wanting to help end industrial animal agriculture and use mushrooms to do it. It just so happens that we visited the same sort of investment community, and they saw a potential of putting us together because Michael had finance, branding, marketing, previous CEO ship and turning a company into something. Even though that company didn't work out, he did all the right things. It just for whatever reason, the women's shoes that, you know, whatever research they did just didn't pan out. But he was a solid founder and a solid CEO, and they were ready to back him again. And he had already been on the journey out finding someone to commercialize a mushroom product. So we got together, and very quickly by October, November, we had founded Fable. We had found a co-manufacturer to work with, put the recipes like into its late stages of development, and we're developing and producing by November, and customers by the end of November and early December, we had our first customers in Australia. And yeah, it's just like, let's go. Ended up that was COVID. Like COVID just started right at the, we hadn't had our long-term, like everything in motion. We were just in motion to go in any direction, which made it really easy for us to pivot really early. And we got into retail really early, but you know, that was because, well, lots of food service was shutting down. But then when food service opened back up, we realized food service was really the channel for us because we wanted to make lots and lots and lots of product and not have to do so much work on the branding and marketing side yet. And which was a lot of resource requirement for a young business. We really put all of our effort into developing a really strong product. Lots of effort goes into the development, and we only make a couple of products every now and then. You know, it's not, we don't have a broad range of, you can go look at a whole section of Fable. No. Fable is just a few different things, because what we ended up coming out with in the beginning, our flagship product, is that chunk that you got to try. We prepared it as barbecue. Go figure, right? I made it originally for that.
That's what I was gonna get to. Was I'm guessing the Texas culture and background had something to do with the barbecue of that product.
Yeah. Well, you see, there was the experience that I wanted to create that I could take back to people so that they would be happy eating that as barbecue, and then all of a sudden you don't feel the pressure of, well, if you're a vegan, you can eat bread and pickles, but we've got no barbecue for you. But here it's like, you've got the fat, the succulents, you've got the meaty fibers and the tear and all of the primal stuff, all of the experiential stuff. And then you can just get rid of all of the stigma around, well, I'm not going to eat that because that's animal. I'm going to eat that. You know, it's like, well, yeah, you've got mushrooms, I'll eat that. So that was the whole idea, is creating an experience where you don't have to, it just makes it easier for someone to want to reduce their resource consumption. That's what I came to it for. And so a lot of passion went into that particular thing. But what it is, that little chunk of mushroom fibers, is the mushroom fibers come from shiitake stems. You would have seen whenever you came and did a little video, I showed you when I was shredding the stems, like they're really robust fibers. Mm-hmm. So when you cook them, those fibers, like the cells of them, sort of collapse and break down. They're elastic and they get more rubbery. And if you do nothing else with them, then you kind of have like a wet, fibrous sort of thing. And it's not that great of an experience. But if you then go the next few steps of what we developed, and that is sort of remove water, remove some of the mushroomy flavor, because shiitake is really strong flavor. Then you can sort of hold all those fibers together, cook them into that form, and now you've got this little chunk that's like a bit of slow cooked meat, and you've held it together with some protein and fat. That's the soy protein that's in there. And then there's coconut oil that essentially just becomes like the collagen matrix that surrounds meat fibers in a muscle. When you bite into it, that stuff kind of breaks apart under the mechanical pressure of your bite, and then you get to experience the fiber rubberiness, and then you break through those, and it's like you get to experience the mouthfeel of biting into a very slow cooked style of a traditional like protein, but it's mushrooms. And yes, it can be confronting to people who haven't had that in a long time, you know, vegans who have stepped away from eating meat. But that's what I did. I worked so that I mimicked the texture of slow cooked traditional proteins and then wrapped them up in a matrix of collagen like, you know, protein and fat. So you get the mouth coating succulents as soon as you bite it, you know, it's like, there it is. And then you get all those fibers that get stuck in your teeth. And then you're like, that was that was a lovely meaty experience, you know, and the fact that it doesn't taste exactly like beef or exactly like lamb or exactly like duck.
Right.
It's just like a generic umami meatiness that you're like, well, if you cook this like lamb, yeah, it works in like Greek lamb. And if you cook this like beef, yeah, it works as brisket or burnt ends. And if you cook it like pork, yeah, that's a butt. Like that's amazing, you know, and that's kind of what it is. And it's a very generic but strong, really robust umami flavor to it. So on its own, even if you do nothing with flavor and you just saute it and put a little salt, it's beautiful and meaty as well. So yeah, that's what Fable is. It's like us reimagining mushrooms into a traditional protein and making it center of plate capable so that a chef can then take a chunk and say, well, I'll serve this as a stew or a curry as a whole chunk, or I'll slice it and I'll make it a stir fry or a Philly cheesesteak, or I'll just pound it and shred it open. And then I'll expose those fibers to a high heat. And then I get like slow cook style, anything like birria or any Mexican preparation that you can think of. We had a few there, but you know, it's like, it lends itself to all the different capabilities of a chef to be creative. And that, I think, is where we've got this real good traction with food service, is that chefs don't like to be pigeonholed. And that's where plant-based is kind of lost out with chefs. It's like, well, all you can do with this is you hold it on a grill for 30 seconds, 30 seconds on the other side, and that's it. Like, now you can do whatever you want with it, but that's what you got to do. In the case of mushrooms, it's like, the harder you cook them, the more you abuse them, you can figure out something new that you can do with them. And, you know, you can grill them, you can steam them, you can smoke them. They absorb flavors. They get the Maillard instantly. You know, you need to add nothing else. So you can turn them into a pate if you like, but you could also like hard cook them until they're cracker crispy and then pour water back onto them. And they've just got a meaty, delicious chew that you've developed to its maximum. So that's what Fable is. That's my passion it come into. That's how I met the co-founders. And that's kind of where we got started. Yeah.
Two questions that just hit me. Yeah. One, because I'm looking at a dry aging machine because I do a lot of dry aging. And yeah. I had this conversation with, you got to meet John James. He's the Fungitarian. He's up here in Chicago. I mean, cool. You got to meet him. I will connect you two because you two would just have a heyday talking mushrooms because he is all things mushrooms.
Yeah.
So I'll make that. But we talked the last time and I was like, I wonder if you could dry age mushrooms. And I didn't know if you'd heard anything or seen anything. Like you're evaporating moisture. I just don't know if the contents of the product would lend or if it would even change flavor by doing so. I don't know. Yeah. Just given your background, I figured I'd ask.
Yeah. Well, so dry aging, definitely. So water is the coolest and worst thing for a cook. Like when you have too much free water, you get bacteria growing. Whenever you remove water enough, you can let something that would naturally spoil stay out and open to the temperatures of the spoilage range and get developments of proteins and carbohydrates and whatever else. So it's like, as a chef, you don't realize it, but your job is to move water around the most efficient way possible. So you would know that as in if you take a wet steak out of the fridge, you want to pat it dry before you put it in contact with the hot surface. That way you'll get the crust formation. Right? That's a very simple way of looking at it. But then as you're developing the temperature of the meat, say you want a medium rare fillet that's 6 inches thick. All right. Now you got to think about how I'm going to move that water around efficiently so I'm not scorching the outside, because once that water is removed, I'm still working on moving water out and pushing heat in. Like moving water around is the whole culinary industry. You're just moving water around. And when you think about ferments and you think about curing and you think about cooking, it's just moving water around. So what you move water in and out of makes the interesting thing occur. In the case of dry aging, you're allowing moisture to be removed enough but still available enough for chemistry to happen. Because if you remove water, no chemistry happens. If you take away the water, you're dry, you're preserved. Yeah. And that's a lot of why salt works, because salt then enables the moisture from doing much whenever it's at a very small amount. But salt can keep things preserved in a lot of water so long as there's a lot of salt, right? But thinking of dry aging is you need to leave enough moisture in for chemistry to happen, but allow enough moisture to leave so that spoilage doesn't happen. And right. cheese is controlled spoilage. Fermentation is controlled spoilage. Right. Dry aging is controlled spoilage. All of it is controlled spoilage. And if you can remove the bacterial element or use the right bacteria, then the spoilage is what you're looking for. In the case of not of, of no spoilage at all, you want to make sure that you've got low enough water activity or moisture activity and high enough to keep the chemistry happening. Now, the chemistry that's happening with meat is based on protein, fat, and to some degree, whatever sugars are around, right? Now, mushrooms have very little fat, but they do have some small amount of protein. Within that, there is plenty of the glutamic acid, the amino acids that end up making the Maillard and umami happen. So yes, if you dry a mushroom, you will see the browning occur. The problem with mushrooms over meat is that they are a fiber matrix. Now we're going back to the fiber thing where proteins are fibrous as far as what their structure is, but that's it. They're not composed of the polysaccharide fiber. Mushrooms are. And if you can just logically think of what fiber does with water, it holds it. And it's really hard to get rid of it. Like you would put, what is it? Psyllium husk. That's all fiber. If you put psyllium husk in water, you see gelatin form. You know, it's like gelatin. It's not gelatin. It's just fibers that are holding on to water. Right, and if you squeeze that, you'll never be able to pull that water out. And if you let it up to the environment, sure, if you're like blowing wind or air movement over it, you can get rid of the water. The hard part of mushrooms is finding where you can have enough chemistry or enough moisture in there to cause chemistry without moving air over it to allow it to remove. So you wouldn't do the same sort of dry aging that you do with meat. You would get them down to a certain moisture content and then allow them to stay there. As they stay there, they will take moisture from the environment so that it would have to be like an intermittent dry aging, right?
Okay.
Because they will reabsorb moisture from the air, whereas protein won't do that. Like the meats won't do that. So you can just kind of continuously let them have smooth air passing over them. With mushrooms, you'd want to bring them quickly down to a certain moisture content, then allow them to stay there for a short period of time, probably up to 24 hours, and then run a little bit of air over them to take away what just got in. Because water gets in, spoilage gets in. And mushrooms are fibers. They're going to pull moisture out of the air. So that's like, I haven't done it, but that's a scientific theoretic approach to doing that.
I love it because I'm always, my mind's always running of what can I do? What can I try as I go down some of this R&D path and working on different products and different things? And what can you dry age potentially? What can you turn into something else to your point? How do we take an ingredient and how do we enhance it? How do we make it even better? Just like, again, looking at it as a waste, you saw opportunity, to be a food source. Yeah. The other question that I was thinking is, before you landed on shiitake, were you trying other mushrooms? Did you go through a phase of, all right, let's try the buttons. Like you said, the one farm had X amount of tons of leftover and then went to this. Or was it pretty just from your background being, a spawn supervisor and being in that environment, like, nah, I know that this is going to have the fiber, structure content that we need to produce the product that we want.
Yeah. Well, it's a whole bunch of things. It's a concerted mechanistic effort. And the original developments that I made were all with the agaricus button mushroom stem, which do have a lot of fiber. And when you treat them in the way that we're doing shiitake now, you can end up with very similar textures and very different tastes. So it's nice for a range of different potential outcomes. The two most widely grown mushrooms in the world are agaricus, white buttons, and shiitake. Back 10 years ago, it was in China and Asia, it was shiitake number one. So that was the largest, widest grown mushroom in the world. And the Western world, number one mushroom was agaricus. And all of the development that led up to that were completely separate. So in agaricus growing, you have composting systems. You grow on straw. It used to be off of manure back in the old days, but now it's just composted straw. And they've got massive substrate volume moving machines to do that type of growing. Whereas shiitake and the exotics, as you would call them in the Western world, are all wood-loving and wood-growing mushrooms. That's all basically grown on virgin wood substrate. So you could take a log off of a tree and inoculate that and grow mushrooms out of it. And then the more rapid version is you take material from a sawmill, you know, sawdust, right, which is small particles that's like fast food for mushrooms, put that in a log and sterilize it behind plastic. And then you can, in a very sterile environment, inoculate that because you've killed off all the
right, the
competitors, essentially. So molds and bacteria are not in there. So whenever you put in the mushroom you want to grow, you got to do that in a really clean, hospital-like environment. So they're essentially performing little surgeries on all these little things, putting in the inoculum. Right. And so that's 10 years ago. What happened is China actually started with the agaricus mushroom, and they started growing a heap of agaricus mushroom. Now, agaricus mushroom is the number one widest grown mushroom in the world. They're growing from these old systems, and as they took them in, the exact same reason that we have 75 tons of mushroom waste here in this one town in Australia is why we would have hundreds of tons of that type of mushroom waste in China and in the Western world. And those systems never developed the ability within the system to extricate the soil. And the soil getting off of the mushroom is very difficult, especially after you've harvested it and threw it into a pile of soil. The soil is everywhere. And the soil tastes like petroleum. It tastes like oil. And if you like wash it, it just absorbs into the fibers.
Right.
So it's a very difficult thing to do. And it is a very high cost for them to ask a picker, because all these mushrooms are handpicked, to basically just cut twice. Cutting twice, and this has been done for the last 100 years, all the economics on it, it just adds too much to the cost of growing mushrooms. Mushrooms need to be a much lower cost so that they're competitive, and there's always new systems coming on. So people cutting off that second bit of soil, it is a very impossible task to ask old mushroom farmers to do that. But with shiitake, it already existed. So that's the second most largest volume of mushrooms grown in the world. They have a very fibrous stem, and the nature of what people want to eat of that mushroom already asks them to remove the stem. So for any market acceptance, especially in the West, of shiitake, and that's what Asia does, is they grow mushrooms for their own population, but they export half or more. They want the stem removed because they don't want to pay for the stem to then get exported over to America or Europe. They want that stem removed in Asia. And that means that there's this massive material that's over in Asia, and it's a low cost picking environment over there. So they do secondary cutting and cleaning. So we had a ready source of material going after shiitake. Now, of course, downstream, we'd love to implement, and we've done all kinds of working on developing cleaning systems for the already growing agaricus. But yeah, it is a cost thing about getting that ingredient. But we know that the ingredient works quite well as long as we can get that cost. So that's just one arm of development and working with very old culture, old world thinkers when you're working with farmers. So the average age of a farmer pretty much anywhere in the world is 60 plus. So they have that old world thinking, and they've already got the established lines of what's cost and what they'll never do. And they'll never involve secondary picking. Now, when we get into automated harvest and robot picking and, you know, future of food, this may be designed into systems, and we will advocate that.
Oh, Very cool. So now you're in the U.S. So you launched everything in Australia, brought to the U.S. Mm. What are some of the biggest challenges, product development, market challenges that you're seeing? Like you said, East, it's always been a very sought out after food. West, not as much, except for like a button mushroom. You know, people look at a mushroom, they go, what in the hell do I do with this? They don't even know what to do. And I was one of those guys for a long time until I had met John and he showed me how to cook lion's mane, how to cook oysters properly. And I was like, so with a little bit of education, I can cook these very efficiently. But what kind of challenges are you seeing coming into the U.S. market?
Yeah, well, I'm going to answer you in two parts. One, quickly on how to cook mushrooms. I espouse a very controversial boiling mushrooms first method. Now, we could go on another half hour talking about why and the science behind that, but my Instagram is Jim Boils Mushrooms. You can go on there and look at the method. I boil pretty much all mushrooms before I do any other cooking, and there is a scientific reason behind it. It makes them more meaty, it makes them more umami, and it makes them less mushroomy. So we can go on to that later if you want.
And that's all mushrooms.
Almost all mushrooms. Now, some mushrooms are perfect fresh. Like if you eat a fresh enoki, or if you like a wood ear type of mushroom, doesn't even require it. But, you know, so it's about the fleshiness. But pretty much all big fleshy mushrooms, yes. Boil them to get their structure the way I want it before I start moving the water around. Because remember when I talked about cooking is moving water around? Mushrooms don't like to let go of their water. The structure is built to absorb water after rain, and it is almost impossible to get your heat into the center of a fleshy mushroom if you're just going to use traditional cooking techniques. And what it does is all that water that's in the center will basically diminish all of your efforts on the outside. And what the problem is with people when they say they don't like mushrooms is because they've had a bad experience. And if the bad experience is just inefficient cooking because the water has like muted the Maillard, muted any crust development, and you get a gray, rubbery, sluggy, slimy, because slimy is in nature to fiber holding on to water. It's not slime, but the fiber holds water and it feels slimy. Think back to psyllium husk, think chia seeds. There's no slime, there's no gel. That's all fiber holding water. And that's the way your mouth experiences it. So when a mushroom doesn't get fully cooked and it's still holding on to its water, it's got raw mushroom taste. It's got rubbery, sluggy slipperiness that people just don't gel with, like gel as the punny term, but people don't like that sort of gelatinous feeling. And anyway, so that's why if you can boil them, you'll get rid of all of that initial mess around, and you can even squeeze some water out after boiling them and then very quick sear or grill or roast or whatever. But I would say you shouldn't do that, because in all of that water is the very delicious umami glutamic acid compound. So what you want to do is you want to work to get that out as quickly as possible, and then to change that with the traditional cooking methods that you're aware of, and then go on with your oil and your sear and your roast. But don't let any of that beautiful flavor stuff go, because that's the impactful thing. When you do it right, people love mushrooms. When you do it right, people are like, oh yeah, I'll eat this with fish, chicken, meat on its own. You know, it backs up everything, but it also stands on its own legs. All right. So there's that. There's that controversial cooking method that I espouse, that definitely boil mushrooms first, but don't just stop at boiling. You go on from there and do more. Now, what was the rest of the question? Because I got stuck on that.
I'm loving this. I'm loving this because I've got to do more research and look in your Instagram more. But it was the biggest challenges in the U.S., right? Between product development, market challenges, et cetera.
Yep. Yeah. All right. So what you find whenever you go global with a company is that every different market has its own different requirements. Labeling is one. You know, it's like what you can say on a label, what is required. Mm. So you can't just make a whole pile of things, put them in a bag, and then sell to America, to China, to U.S., to Malaysia, to Australia. No. You have to make the food specifically for the market. That's one thing. So whenever you're a company and owning and storing a backlog of ingredients so that you have them ready to go all the time, you got to think, well, what market am I preparing the most for? What market is going to allow me to say what? And what are the claims that you can make, or the things that you have to say, like, you know, made in a facility with nuts, or whatever, what sort of testing you got to do to make all those claims. Like, all of that in itself is a business. All of that in itself, it requires a resource of a big resource of a business. Now, when you get into markets like America, this is this could be controversial. So I'll go very easy around it. But America has its own ideas around food and what is good and what is bad, and it's not necessarily based in fact. That being said, what is a fact? So MSG is one, right? MSG has a cultural stigma. MSG has a bad rap in America, but basically nowhere else in the world. And why? As a chef, you know that this is flavor dynamic. You know that it is amazing. It's an excitatory neurotransmitter. It makes you happy. And all those downstream things that it says are likely bad or that are related to, I don't know, Chinese syndrome. I don't know. Like, I remember having the stigma when I was there, like even going into Chinese restaurants saying we do not use MSG. That is sad. That is such a sad thing. Because
if a Chinese restaurant says we don't use MSG, I'm not eating there, because that's the bad Chinese restaurant, right? Yeah, when you go to a new place and you're like, what's the good Chinese place? Yeah. Just ask them, do you use MSG in your food?
Yeah.
And if they say no, you know it's not the good Chinese restaurant, because the best Chinese you've ever had contains MSG. Now, whether that's naturally occurring or they're sprinkling it on, that's what makes you want that food. That is why it is so good. And I'm with you again on that. What is good? What is bad? We could go on all day about opinions of that.
Let me allay people's fears around like natural and synthetic, because synthetic doesn't require really anything other than boiling something and then getting rid of the solid part and then concentrating it down and then getting a salt out of it. Like, because that will happen with mushrooms. Mushrooms have naturally occurring glutamates that when you boil a mushroom and you get the extract, I challenge you to do this. Go take a drop of that. Go just go get an agaricus mushroom, drop it in some boiling water, put a whole punnet in there, drop them in boiling water, and then take those mushrooms out and cook them. Take that existing extract, put one drop of it onto a stainless steel surface and just wait for it to evaporate away, and you'll see the salt crystals forming. Then taste it. That's MSG. But then go on with that extract and boil it down into a beautiful reduction and see how meaty that stuff is. When we're working with yeast extract or fungi extract, everybody knows in the plant-based world, if you're going to add something umami to your dishes, it's going to come from the fungi world. Yeast extract is fungi, right? Here in Australia, if you have a Sunday roast, you'll roast in the oven, and then they make a quick gravy here. It's called Maggi gravy, but it is yeast extract that's held together with a little bit of starch binder, and it is what people eat for their roast, because it the same compounds that exist in meat when you cook them with the Maillard are the same compounds that get formed when you perform the Maillard on mushrooms. Exact same. Mushrooms are more closely related to animals than they are to plants, evolutionarily speaking. So we're both more closely related to each other than either of us are related to the plant kingdom. And that means the stuff on the inside of the cell is really, really similar. So when you cook a traditional protein and you get those delicious meaty tastes, you can cook a mushroom and get that stuff out of the cell, then do the Maillard, and you get the same outputs.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's all of that. So that's allaying the fears around MSG. And the other one in America is soy. They've got really bad things maybe going on with soy farming over there. So there's a soy, like a soy aversion, and people think, you know, you're going to get breasts or whatever. Soy is a really mature, eaten for centuries sort of thing. And it is super functional and super easy to use without having to use much of it. So if you want to cut soy out of a thing, and the reason I'm using it is for its function, it's like holding stuff together. I'm not using it for taste, and only very slightly using it for texture of holding those fibers together. But if I were to use something else, I'm going further away because I want to hold these fibers together. And mushrooms,
they'll do amazing things, but they're not going to, after you've shredded them apart from themselves, they're not going to hold on to each other. You need a protein to do that, yeah. or you need a binder to do that. And if I were to use something else, it's going to be something else developed in science, or it's going to be egg whites, which is not vegan, or it's going to be a protein that I put together. And soy is the most functional of all the plant versions of proteins. The most strongest, the easiest to use, the most available, the one that you can get organically grown, the one that you can get without, you know, bad practices, the ones that you can get. So it's like soy has the most behind it that you could use and be happy with, but it's got that bad stigma around it in the U.S. really only. Mm-hmm. So when we make products for the U.S., soy has to be called out big time, you know, and it is a bit of a deterrent for a lot of people. They're like, yeah, we just don't do soy. We just don't do soy. We just don't do soy. And they won't even think about why.
Wow. Man, I know we're coming up on time. I could probably talk to you for another 2 hours about the science of this and what you're doing. Maybe sometime when you get to the U.S., maybe you can come over to the studio. We can do some cooking and talking some more. Again, I don't know how often you get over, but we could really throw down up here in Chicago. Doing some really cool stuff, showing what can be done with the product and more of a life example. Cool. I love doing that. So if you're ever up for that, let me know. Yeah. I would love to have you come in and we could do a full on, especially with your background of it's one thing to talk to like R&D. It's another to talk to R&D that has real world cooking background that understands what's happening, not just the science part of it, they understand the mouthfeel, the umami. Why we want to use certain products. You understand that. So when you do R&D, it just kind of meshes together. But your story is just out of this world. I am so glad that I was able to, you know, chat with you today, go through that, show people, and hopefully more will start to say, what is it? You know, how do I get my hands on it? And we can just get more awareness because, again, I work with John and his team and bringing just Fungitarian. His goal is to have like 1 million or 100 million fungitarians or something. It's crazy. I love his mission.
Let's do that.
If people want to find you, where do they go to check out what you're doing, what Fable's got going on, etc.?
Yeah. Yeah. Fablefood.co. That is our website. That's one word, fablefood.co. And it's fablefoodco on Insta. So at fablefoodco. Those are our two main channels, but of course we're there on LinkedIn and have the other presences, but those are our probably two main channels of working with people. And the website's going through a revamp, so you'll be able to see where it's available in all the different countries that it's in. I think those are the easiest ways to get to us. And I'm Jim Boyle's Mushrooms on Insta.
All right. You heard the man. This is my, I don't know, fourth iteration with mushrooms or mushroom farmers to some degree. Nice. I absolutely love it. I think we need to talk more about it, eat more of it. I love mushrooms. I'm a mushroom fanatic. So go check them out. Go see what they're about. The product is phenomenal. I ate it at NRA and it literally stopped me in my tracks on the last day. I'm exhausted to have a quick conversation that now led to this podcast. So go check them out. You won't be disappointed. So Jim, thanks again for coming on. And until next time,
thanks, Jeff.
We'll catch you on the sunny side. Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.